May it please the Court, Kate Aronson representing Adam Norcross, the appellant with co-counsel Joseph Gavay. Good morning. In December 2010, this Court remanded Mr. Norcross's co-defendant's case, Ralph Swan, because the trial court failed to address recent Supreme Court and Third Circuit opinions, among which were Williams v. Taylor, Wiggins, Rompilla, Porter, Jerram v. Horn, and Alton. At a minimum, this Court should remand Mr. Norcross's case to the trial court for consideration of those exact same opinions, which are relevant to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim with respect to the penalty phase. But because this Court's review is de novo, it's Mr. Norcross's position that the ineffective assistance of counsel in the investigation of the penalty phase is so clear, and in combination or when coupled with the prosecutorial misconduct in the penalty phase and denigration of the mitigation evidence presented, that actually a remand for a new penalty phase is appropriate. The issue in this case is the reasonableness of counsel's mitigation investigation and presentation. There are multiple categories which were not investigated: lay witnesses, documentary evidence, but most importantly, the failure to investigate Norcross's history of mental issues as well as mental impairment. Now, the right to counsel does not require that every stone is unturned, but it does require a reasoned judgment as to the amount of investigation the particular circumstances of a case require. And in this case, trial counsel halted the investigation, and halting the investigation was not a reasoned judgment. Two experts were retained initially by trial counsel, both of whom said there was nothing that they could offer with respect to guilt phase issues. However, they could be helpful in mitigation. We would need to see Mr. Norcross again. Please provide whatever records you have. Any corroboration of statements Mr. Norcross had made regarding his childhood, etc. Trial counsel completely drops the ball. Dr. Mechanic recommended additional psychological testing. That was never arranged. Dr. Mensch, the psychologist, suggested neuropsychological testing. That was never conducted. Neuropsych testing conducted during the course of the post-conviction proceedings documented that Norcross has brain damage, which was not uncovered nor presented by trial counsel. A diagnosis of ADHD, which was suggested to Norcross's mother when Norcross was in elementary school, was confirmed through testing during post-conviction proceedings. Dr. Mensch suspected a post-traumatic stress disorder. Diagnosis during his preliminary meeting with Mr. Norcross, that also was confirmed. Trial counsel in the post-conviction proceedings concedes that if trial counsel had known that Norcross had a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder and that Dr. Mensch had reached a preliminary diagnosis of that, they would have called him in the penalty phase to present that mitigation evidence. Trial counsel in this case...
Didn't Dr. Mechanic state or testify that he did not see any reason for a neurological evaluation or to test for attention deficit disorder?
That's correct, but that was different than what was previously provided to trial counsel by Dr. Mensch. And records that were obtained by the PFEs, the psychoforensic evaluators, in the PD's office, school records, indicated that there was a learning disability, as well as being put on notice by Mr. Norcross's mother that in elementary school the teachers had suggested ADHD testing.
Well, what if counsel finds, if Dr. Mensch says one thing, Dr. Mechanic says another, can they reasonably rely on one expert?
They have a duty to investigate, and when one expert, and it is the expert who typically conducts those psychological tests, is the one that's recommending that testing, then no, it is not reliable. It's not reasonable to rely solely on a psychiatrist's suggestion. Particularly in this case, when none of the experts had records at the time that they preliminarily met with Mr. Norcross. And in those immediate correspondence by email from the PD's office to, from the experts to the PD's office, those experts at that time didn't have the benefit of interview summaries conducted by mitigation experts or the records. So at that point in time, no. To stop the investigation after identifying potential mitigating factors and mitigating factors that should have been further explored was not a reasoned judgment. And what's interesting about this case is when trial counsel started the penalty phase, they indicated to the jury that there was evidence of psychological problems, and they would hear testimony about that. It never happened. They weren't prepared to present it. They indicated that he would do well in a structured prison environment and that he was not a future danger in a prison environment to staff and other inmates. They were not at that point in time prepared to present anything on that mitigating factor. They also told the jury in opening that Norcross was a follower of the violent swan and had done nothing to investigate that mitigator and was unprepared to present it. The trial court erroneously held that the defense strategy of humanizing Mr. Norcross excused the deficient investigation in this case. And in Porter, the Supreme Court said that simply because a strategy is reasonable in the abstract does not excuse an inadequate investigation. And if this court permits trial counsel to hide behind the strategy of humanizing a defendant as a reason for not investigating mitigation, then post-conviction proceedings become meaningless. Every attorney could raise the shield and say, during post-conviction testimony, I didn't look into that because my strategy was to humanize the defendant. There is...
Well, let me ask you a question about that. That's interesting, and I understand how you believe it applies in this factual scenario, but what if counsel reasonably adopts a strategy that's supported by substantial evidence and could investigate an alternative strategy, but an alternative strategy that's arguably inconsistent with that strategy? Isn't not a professional judgment about whether to further investigate the latter? Do you have to investigate every loose end?
You do not. A trial counsel does not have to investigate every loose end. However, there has to be an investigation on all fronts, and only when it is reasonable to abandon the investigation on a specific or particular issue can a strategy to pursue another line be reasonable.
All right. I realize that death is different and these cases are extraordinarily important, but let's assume, because of both the burden of time and expense in these cases, somebody has adopted a strategy, investigated it to within the limits in their professional judgment is adequate to be persuasive. Do they still have a continuing obligation to go on even further in developing that single strategy?
Well, the question becomes then whether that initial judgment was reasonable. And the issue's not it's not that counsel presents some mitigation. The question is, if they had pursued the other line of investigation, what is the quality of that mitigation evidence, and is there a likelihood that the totality of the omitted evidence would have made a difference on the result? So it comes back to, if they didn't go down the road of investigation, was it reasonable at the time? What would they have uncovered if they did, and how would that have impacted overall in the totality of evidence presented, and would it have potentially led to a different result?
Did the Superior Court judge make that analysis in post-conviction review, looking at the totality of the alleged omitted evidence in determining prejudice?
The trial judge did a piecemeal analysis, taking each individual lay witness, each separate piece of documentary evidence, and each expert opinion, and did not look at it in the totality and reweigh it against mitigation presented at the penalty phase, mitigation not presented but uncovered during post-conviction, reweigh all mitigation then against the aggravating evidence. And no, that did not occur in the trial court's opinion.
And if the trial, assume we remand for that purpose, if the trial judge makes that determination, our review of that is de novo, but does that end the matter if we agree?
It would then be a question of whether, one, it would be an abuse of discretion in the analysis, but you would then, as a de novo, have the opportunity to reweigh all of it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Gabay will address the prosecutorial misconduct and other arguments.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Joseph Gabay, Your Honors, we asked the clerk to allow us 5 minutes for rebuttal. I presume that if I don't run into that time, that would be acceptable to the court?
Yes.
Thank you. this case, I want to address a couple of the points to start the argument that Your Honors raised to Ms. Aronson. And the first one is this concept of attorneys using the humanization as a shield. I don't have the benefit of reading every brief that you all get in death penalty cases, but quite frankly, the cases that we develop on post-conviction, in fact, that's exactly what they do. We want to preserve the credibility of the defendant. We want to humanize him. And the problem here is that humanization, A, didn't occur because the reasons Ms. Aronson gave you of where they dropped the ball. I mean, this isn't the Chief Justice asked a question, is there an alternative strategy? Well, in this case, it wasn't even an issue of an alternative strategy. It was you are supposed to go out, whether we impose the guidelines per se or whether we take them as ABA guidelines, you're supposed to go out and talk to people. You're supposed to talk to the mother. You're supposed to talk to the sister. You're supposed to talk to the 26-year-old who seduced the 15-year-old defendant. You're supposed to get records. These aren't novel concepts, and Your Honors know that. And the attorneys are supposed to know that. And they did none of that. So it's not – the appellant is not saying that there is an alternative strategy they could have picked, because they never developed the strategy that they were relying upon. And what that did in this case was that leads into the issues which are presented with the prosecutorial misconduct, because by their failure to conduct that investigation, they basically segue right into the state's ability to make comments, references, and introduce testimony, which so infect and inflamed this proceeding that even at one point the trial judge did say at a lunch after a lunch and recess did say, isn't there a little too much emotion? He refused to allow a videotape of Mr. Warren playing with his child, and yet still, with that as a background, the state puts on the testimony of Sergeant Booker to say, with an opinion that is remarkably remote in time, for which there is really no foundation and which does not, we would suggest, comport with Delaware's expert opinion findings, to say that basically, Norcross was a man without a conscience. Right? That the trial judge in this case, even in his sentencing opinion, said that there's a credibility problem with Mr. Norcross. On post-conviction, he says there's a credibility problem with Mr. Norcross. Well, how does one, as an attorney, deal with the credibility issue? And that is, you present the evidence that corroborates those credibility problems. And as we all know, in this instance, there was a remarkable amount of evidence adduced at the post-conviction that talked about the adolescence abuse, the bestiality, the absolutely disturbing behavior by Mr. Berry towards Mr. Norcross, the fact that he was abandoned, the fact that he was misled about his biological father, the sexual abuse, the issues in jail, all these things that would have been explained to the jury. And yet,
Mr. Gabay, as I understand it, the thrust of the defense position is that trial counsel inadequately investigated in preparation for the mitigation stage. And had there been an adequate investigation, it would have made a difference in the outcome. Is that a fair statement of your position?
That's the first part, and that's an absolutely fair statement, Justice
okay.
Jacobs.
Would you also agree that it was your side's burden to show that the type of investigation that you're advocating should have been made would make a difference?
Absolutely. And
okay. And there, it is correct, is it not, that there was a multi-day evidentiary hearing so that the court could determine, number one, what the investigation that your side advocates would have revealed, and secondly, once having determined that, whether that would have made a difference. And having evaluated the evidence on both of those issues, the trial court said, concluded that it would not have made a difference.
Well,
now, what are we to do with all of the of that post-conviction evidence which took place, that is, that was presented over a multi-day period and considered by the trial judge? The arguments that I'm hearing sort of assume that this never happened and that we should just ignore all of that.
Justice Jacobs, I guess the first way I would respond to it is to say I think in terms of talking about the factual foundation that brings us to this court today, you're absolutely right. I think, however, if we look at history, what we see is that this court is the only court that reverses death sentences on post-conviction. And so I don't think what I hear Your Honor suggesting is, well, the trial judge listened to all this, decided it wouldn't have made a difference.
You're basically saying that we have to either overturn or disregard the conclusions, the findings, and the conclusions that were reached as a result of this post-conviction live hearing. And I agree with you that we have, suppose, the power to do that, but it has to be according to some standard. And my question is, what is the standard by which we review?
Well, I agree with that. But I think part of the problem comes from if the Superior Court judges were actually giving effect to the same arguments that we're making, which is the cause and prejudice. And I think that's where I'm going to address Your Honor's question.
Well, before you do it, what is the standard?
The standard is the cause and prejudice, the prejudice that Mr. Norcross suffers by this evidence not being presented. Did he suffer prejudice by either, A, the failure to properly conduct a mitigation investigation, but secondarily, in this case, the prejudicial effect of the conduct which we raise an argument to, which is with the prosecution.
Well, the prejudice or lack thereof finding is either a question of fact or it's a mixed question of fact and law. Would you agree?
I believe it's a mixed question, and I believe it's a de novo review.
And a de novo review?
Yes, sir.
If it's a de novo review, does that mean we refine the facts or simply review whether the conclusions that were drawn from those facts?
I believe in certain circumstances, Justice Jacobs, you can review the facts because you're required to apply state law to the facts. And I think because otherwise, when we trip into the habeas status, if this case were to get that far, which we suggest it should, and this should get reversed for a new penalty hearing, but we'd have to attack whether this court appropriately applied state law. And so, yes, I do believe that you can reanalyze how the facts and the law combined are applicable to Mr. Norcross's claims. And the claim of the prosecutorial misconduct with, for example, the cross-examination. And this court has spent the last 15 years essentially re-lecturing the Attorney General's office on what's appropriate and what's not appropriate and what the guidelines say. And we listed it in our brief, and we could wear out a lot of ink checking off where they went wrong with them. The fact of the matter is, in this case, by way of example, and to start the whole thing, the cross-examination, of Mr. Norcross basically talked about every event that bothers society today, as though, you got this evidence that you're presenting, but it's not really mitigation. And that's essentially what they did. They ultimately compared the victim to Mr. Norcross. And that's not right. That exceeds the boundaries of pain. That goes well beyond it. It goes back to what Justice Black said in the Williams case years ago, and it was quoted in Justice Stevens' dissent, which talks about when you're dealing with individualized sentencing, yes, you're allowed under pain a quick glimpse of the victim. You're not allowed what they had here. And you're also not allowed to compare and contrast, because when you compare and contrast any victim with someone convicted of potentially capital murder, that destroys a balancing test of how you weigh the aggravators versus the mitigators, and destroys Mr. Norcross's ability to have individualized sentencing. They denigrated each and every part of the mitigation that was underdeveloped, non-existent essentially, and basically held him up as a man without a conscience. When you say that to a jury, is that the effect that those jurors, and the conscience being an interesting concept here, because in reality, the conscience of the community was taken out of the instructions by the trial judge. And we raised that as I believe, argument three, that the trial judge's instructions weren't correct. That's not a correct statement. They are the conscience of the community. But to be the true conscience of the community, they should hear everything there was to hear within reason about Mr. Norcross.
You raised a question about your rebuttal.
Yes, sir, and I see I'm into it.
You're well into it.
Yes. May I wrap up, and then I'll save the balance of the time. Essentially what we have is, I believe our brief set out where the problems come in. Arguments one and two meld together. And this court, I think, needs to send a message, particularly in this case. I mean, A, it at worst it gets remanded. But B, I think this is the case, the appellant believes this is the case, where you look at it and you say, this investigation falls so short, the misconduct was so significant, we're not going to waste our time of sending it back, getting an opinion back from a judge who quite frankly short-shifted a little bit of the hearing and just wanted to get, as you saw, he wanted to look at it individually. He didn't want to look at it collectively. I don't think Mr. Norcross can be confident that sending it back is going to get him a neutral assessment on what Justice Ridgely asked about. And with all that in mind, this case deserves a new penalty hearing now, not after a remand. Thank you.
(Clears throat) Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. I'll attempt to address the arguments in the order they were presented. The first and second argument, I think, have been the focus here.
Mr. Williams, before you do that, what's the state's position with regard to a remand?
Well, I don't think a remand's necessary in this case. As Justice Jacobs pointed out, the trial judge was also the judge for the post-conviction proceeding. He heard 8 days of in-court testimony. There were 2 additional days of deposition testimony. And the judge has indicated, at least as to the prejudice prong, that it would not have affected the 3 death sentences that he imposed. Under the Delaware statutory scheme, the trial judge is the final determiner in the death penalty prosecutions as to what the sentence will be. The jury recommendation was 10-2, and whether that changes somewhat or not, the trial judge indicated that at least his final determination as to whether or not a death penalty was appropriate or not was not going to change. So I don't know that a remand is going to make any difference there, and it certainly doesn't appear to be necessary. There's been full opportunity.
Well, isn't it correct that in Williams v. Taylor, the U.S. Supreme Court criticized the Virginia Supreme Court in this way? The state Supreme Court's prejudice determination was unreasonable insofar as it failed to evaluate the totality of the available mitigation evidence, both that adduced at trial and the evidence adduced in the habeas proceeding, or by analogy, the Rule 61 proceeding. And specifically, an analogy is coming to my mind is that the state, on the issue of probable cause, for example, has appealed to this court when a trial judge has individually determined that this factor doesn't establish probable cause, that factor doesn't establish probable cause, and the state has argued that the totality of the circumstances does establish probable cause, and we've reversed and remanded on that ground. So why shouldn't this trial judge address, under that formulation of the U.S. Supreme Court, the totality of the circumstances, not just the individual claims of prejudice for failure to do A, B, C, and D, but whether they all add up to prejudice? Or did he? I mean, the other side says he did not.
Well, I don't know that he did explicitly. I think in the end, though, when he reaches the conclusion that it would not have changed the result at the penalty hearing or the sentence, that assumes he's considered all that. He's gone through them fairly systematically as to each of the matters that were presented and indicates why he doesn't think that particular bit of evidence is going to make any difference. And in the end, when he has to address the second prejudice prong, that's the ultimate conclusion. It can certainly be remanded for that purpose, but I don't think it's necessary to state it explicitly. I think it's inherent in the reasoning that the trial judge has adopted. In addition to Williams,
hasn't the Third Circuit Court of Appeals expressed concern in at least 2 cases about the way this court has dealt with the application of the Strickland standard?
Well, I think, I don't know if you're referring to Rampalla or not, but there are Third Circuit decisions, and I think, you know, that's out there. That usually comes up in the context of a federal habeas corpus review and the application of state law here. I mean, it can be remanded for that purpose, and it's been remanded in Swan so the judge can make those additional findings if necessary. But I think they're inherent in the decision. I mean, the judge has written a fairly lengthy opinion on the Rule 61, and if you combine that with the original sentencing opinion that was issued in 2001 for both Swan and Norcross, I think it's fairly explicit there what the court's reasoning was, what the factors were the trial judge considered, and ultimately what the judge's conclusion was. In this context, we're talking about whether or not there was ineffective assistance of counsel and whether counsel should have done more. That's an abuse of discretion standard there, and the state's position is that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in ultimately denying post-conviction relief here. The first argument concerns whether or not counsel was ineffective at the penalty hearing. There was 2 days of deposition testimony from two employees, actually former employees, the Public Defender's Office, Sherry Gelati and Linda Zervas. They testified in detail, and numerous exhibits were introduced at the deposition testimony that was later considered by the trial judge as part of the Rule 61 post-conviction evidentiary proceeding about what records were investigated, what individuals were interviewed in preparation for a penalty hearing. It was fairly obvious to the Public Defender's Office at the beginning that Mr. Norcross had made at least 4 incriminatory admissions prior to his trial in this case as to his involvement in the homicide, and that it certainly seemed apparent that he was probably going to be convicted during the guilt phase. So preparation began early on for the penalty phase. Voluminous documents were gathered here. One of the contentions has been that certain school records dealing with a stay at a juvenile wilderness camp in Virginia in 1985 and 1986, the New Dominion school records, were not explicitly introduced, and those could have been used to show that Mr. Norcross responds better in a structured environment as opposed to a non-structured environment, that he had progressed fairly well at the New Dominion school. The trial judge considered that evidence, but he also considered it in the context of the other evidence that was presented back at the original penalty hearing and said, well, yes, that's true. This is when he was 15 and 16 years old, but we also had evidence at the penalty hearing about his Marine Corps records. He enlisted in the Marine Corps when he was 22 years old. He was discharged during basic training on the basis of a less than honorable discharge, and Gunnery Sergeant Booker testified about his supervision and evaluation of Mr. Norcross during the penalty hearing in 2001. So I think there was appropriate investigation done, both record investigation and interviewing of witnesses. 8 witnesses testified at the original 2001 penalty hearing in May. 4 additional lay witnesses were presented 6 years later at the Rule 61 evidentiary hearing in the Superior Court. The state's position has been laid out in the answer and brief. There were problems with each and every one of these 4 additional witnesses. Kathleen Norcross, the mother, did not testify at trial, and the trial attorneys explained their reasoning that they were very concerned that she was going to commit perjury, that she was not willing to accept responsibility for any of Norcross's problems in childhood and was simply distancing herself. Ruth Corey, she was the lady who had the affair with Norcross when he was 15 years old. She was 26. It resulted in the birth of the child, Katie Corey. Katie Corey was 12 years old when her father was arrested, and 13 years old at time of trial, and she really didn't visit her father in prison until after age 18. So her utility at a penalty hearing would certainly be extremely limited. Finally, Faith Smith was one of the aunts who wasn't called. Another aunt, Betty Scullion, did testify at the Rule 61 hearing, and Faith Smith's testimony at the Rule 61 hearing was certainly troubling in some respects, that she indicated that Norcross had never told her that he had actually fired the shot that killed the homicide victim here. And she said that his testimony at the new trial hearing for Mr. Swan that was conducted in 2006 or 2007, that was all news to her, that she had never heard anything about this character. I think she described him as a fictional person named Wayne, that all the explanations Mr. Norcross had given before it indicated that he had committed the homicide and the break-in at the house with Ralph Swan, not an individual named Wayne. And finally, Faith Smith testified at the Rule 61 that Norcross has a tendency not to tell the truth. Given that type of mixed bag, the decision by trial counsel was not unreasonable in not presenting any of these four additional lay witnesses. The school records evidence, yes, they could have introduced the evidence at the New Dominion school, but when you compare that to the later evidence about his performance at the Marine Corps, which the trial judge said is certainly a very structured environment, he didn't do well there, so you can't say that that was going to win the day, showing that he does much better in a structured environment. Finally, the expert psychological and psychiatric testimony, both Dr. Mensch, the examining psychologist, and Dr. Mechanic, the examining psychiatrist, testified at the Rule 61 hearing. They did not testify at the original penalty hearing, and the problems were that both of those individuals had trouble with Norcross's credibility. He had given varying accounts about how the homicide had occurred. There was concern by both doctors of a diagnosis of an antisocial personality, and neither one thought that was going to be helpful to be presented at a penalty hearing to the jury, telling them, and this expert medical psychologist or psychiatrist's opinion, he has an antisocial personality. That's not going to be helpful, and that's a reasonable decision and a basis for not presenting that type of testimony.
What about the defendant's position or Norcross's position that there's brain damage that was not presented, evidence of brain damage?
Well, Dr. Mechanic said that he didn't see any reason for a neurological evaluation. So I think what we have here is a battle of experts. There's a new physician who's examined him and thinks that there is that possibility. But again, even if it is assumed he does have brain damage, what is a jury to do with that? Does that in any way affect how this particular crime was committed and what the background of this individual was? The state's position is it doesn't, that this seemed to be a very planned out in advance burglary. The original target was Norcross's uncle's home. They were going to go there and steal a gun. I think it was a World War I rifle, and then try to sell that. But then when it turned out that there was someone home, they had to pick another target and just randomly pick this home in Kenton. They purchased camouflage clothing, ski masks to conceal their identity. They had a target. They drove from Newcastle to Kent County to commit the crime. Afterwards, they disposed of the camouflage clothing and the ski mask. The firearms used appear to have been stolen from a former roommate of Norcross shortly before the homicide occurred. So there was a whole lot of pre-planning and preparation. Even if he has brain damage and has attention deficit disorder, which Dr. Mechanic didn't see from the school records either, didn't prevent him from committing this crime.
Mr. Williams, I suppose the other side would agree that there was pre-planning. But they would argue that had there been an adequate evidentiary presentation of the brain damage coupled with having grown up in an abusive environment, that what you had here was basically a person so needy that he was just following along and doing whatever Swan wanted him to do. That is, whatever pre-planning took place was all Swan's pre-planning, and Norcross just went along, and that should be considered or should have been considered as a mitigating factor.
Well, I think that was the argument, that he was the follower and Swan was the instigator. Of course, the problem that Norcross now has is that he's got up on the stand in the Superior Court in Swan's post-conviction proceeding in a new trial motion and said Swan wasn't even involved. It was this fellow named Wayne.
But so, that's the other side of the argument. I mean, right. As I understand it, it takes two interpretations of the facts to make up an argument, and there just wasn't enough fact presented to the jury to enable the defense to make a fair argument, whether or not that argument would have won the day.
Well, I think there was. The problem with a lot of the defense mitigation evidence is it only comes from Mr. Norcross. He did testify at his penalty hearing in some detail, and he presents a litany of sensational, bizarre events that happened in his childhood. The trial judge apparently does give some credence to that in the ultimate sentencing opinion in 2001. He indicates that there was a troubled childhood, nomadic childhood. There was evidence of physical and sexual abuse as a child.
Right. He and Mr. Norcross did testify to that as a lay witness. But the argument was that had there been an adequate presentation through the physicians, you know, of those same facts, then it wouldn't have been necessary for Norcross to testify at all.
Well, I don't know about that. I guess it would be, you'd have to bring it in as a hearsay exception, and normally that you get those kind of reports in if they're for diagnosis and treatment, but I don't know. I mean, I think you're certainly going to have some evidence presented. I guess you can present it secondhand. It usually has a better effect upon a trier of fact if they hear it firsthand from the horse's mouth, but I guess that decision could be made to avoid that.
So your response is that it's not so clear that they could have avoided putting Norcross on the stand?
No, I think if they were going to have any ultimate effect here, they're going to have to put him on the stand, and he's going to have to offer some explanation about his childhood. And the trial judge seemed to accept a lot of what he said, even though it was uncorroborated by any other source and has still been uncorroborated to this day, 10 years after the trial, that these are self-reports that Mr. Norcross has made. The difficulty is Mr. Norcross has told at least six different versions of how the homicide occurred. And depending
Getting to that credibility issue, wouldn't the psychiatrist, psychologist, medical people be very significantly helpful in providing some level of explanation for Norcross's personality, including his tendency to lie, in terms of explaining what the limitations are, his mental limitations and his upbringing and his traumatic experiences?
Well, they could do that. It's a two-edged sword in this particular case, and both Mechanic indicated they had problems with the credibility. One of the concerns that Dr. Mechanic expressly stated was that if he's going to keep telling these different versions of what happened and his story changes depending upon the circumstances, that indicates to me a lack of remorse. And if I'm going to be asked, is he remorseful, I'm going to have to say, well, it doesn't appear so because he just makes up whatever convenient stories happen at the time, and they're not even consistent. So I think that's the two edges there, and the trial judge had to weigh all of that in deciding whether or not it was reasonable or unreasonable not to put these particular mental health experts on the stand. I think the conclusion was that there was certainly a danger. If you're going to put doctors on the stand who are going to say he's antisocial, he exhibits a lack of remorse, we're having trouble believing anything he says, none of that's going to be helpful at a mitigation phase, and it's certainly going to undermine the self-reports of these other incidents by Mr. Norcross, who's really the only source of a lot of these more sensational things, particularly the alleged conduct of John Barry, the mother's second husband here. So I think that was the difficulty here, and I think ultimately, in retrospect, it was probably a reasonable decision by trial counsel. Having heard all of this now at the 2007-2008 8 days of hearings, the trial judge indicates, well, you know, I've heard all this now, but it doesn't change my ultimate decision here. So I think that's where it fails on the prejudice prong as well. There's also been some discussion about the second argument here about alleged prosecutorial misconduct, and it has to deal with three different statements made by the prosecutor, or actually one.
On this prejudice prong,
yes.
The other side's addressing if just one juror, two jurors, three jurors had changed their mind, that's all the test that has to be satisfied. you're saying that the ultimate test is whether the trial judge would have reached a different result. Which is it, and does it matter depending upon the statutory scheme in a one state as compared to another as to which it is? Which is it? What's the test for prejudice?
Well, excuse me, I'm sorry. It definitely depends on what the statutory scheme in one state or the other is. If you have a hybrid kind of statute, which I guess is what some commentators describe the Delaware one as, you can't really compare hybrid states to non-hybrid states. And what you have to look at in deciding all of this is what the jury's role is here. The jury has two roles under our statute as it's been changed since 91. They have to first make a finding beyond a reasonable doubt of the existence of at least one statutory aggravator. That's the Ring fact-finding role that the jury has. They then have really a role to find by preponderance of the evidence whether the aggravators outweigh the mitigators in the case. And then that latter determination is a recommendation to the trial judge. The vote in this case was 10-2 that the aggravators outweighed the mitigators by the jury. The argument has been made that if even one juror changed his or her mind, that that would make a difference. The state's position is no, it wouldn't. The best evidence we have here is look at Mr. Swan's case. Mr. Swan's jury recommendation was 7-5. Mr. Swan engages in virtually the same conduct as Mr. Norcross. Mr. Swan has an equally troubled upbringing as well, and he also received the death penalty from the same trial judge. There were separate trials, but the judge was the same in each case. So I think given that kind of record here, that you can't say that the fact that maybe one juror would have changed his or her mind or two jurors is ultimately going to carry the day, because ultimately the final decision comes down to the trial judge under Delaware statutory.
Well, you're basically saying that criterion or test is not a useful analytical tool in a hybrid structure that we have here.
No, I don't think it is. I mean, it's, you know, arguing that, well, if we just change one juror's mind, that would make all the difference in the world. Well, no, it wouldn't. And you've got perfect evidence here. I mean, so
I understand that argument. And what you're saying is would have to be less than five people. That is, you would have to change at least three jurors' minds, or maybe four or five, and who knows? There's no objective way to apply that test, you know, when the jury's function is basically recommendation and not the penalty decision itself.
Yes, I think that's true. And the jury does have a limited role when it comes to the penalty phase. I mean, they certainly have the initial fact-finding role, and under Ring, they have to make a determination beyond a reasonable doubt that a statutory aggravator exists. And once that happens, then the person is death eligible, and then it's just a question of what the jury recommends.
You have less than 2 minutes left. Are you going to address the alleged prosecutorial misconduct?
Yes, I'll certainly try to do that. There were questions. The first question was a question on cross-examination about the Jerry Springer show. The trial judge, I think, dealt with that effectively. He said, well, it probably wasn't the most seemly way to end a cross-examination, but it wasn't any bitter exchange between the two. The purpose of cross-examination is certainly to challenge the credibility of a witness, and I think while better language probably should have been utilized, it's not ultimately something that changed the result at the penalty phase hearing. Comparison of the victim and the defendant, I think what the prosecutor was doing was simply saying, look, you know, victim impact evidence has been presented by the state. The defendant's presented his own mitigation evidence. Here's what all of the evidence is. And the jury has to draw their conclusions from that. That was not objected to. The last thing I think was a comment in closing argument that the defendant's background didn't justify or excuse the murder. And the trial judge, I think, appropriately analyzed that even if that's erroneous, at worst it's harmless error in this case, because the trial judge was the one who instructed the jury what the evidence was to be considered in mitigation and what the lawyer's responsibility was there.
Have we reached the stage in establishing aggravators or challenging mitigators that we call people from the past to give their opinion on whether the defendant has or has not a conscience?
No, I that was unusual testimony, but I think it was certainly appropriate that that was Gunnery Sergeant Booker's job, was to evaluate these new Marine recruits, and the problem he had was that this guy stole supplies, and he recommended that he be dropped out.
Let's not argue with the Marines wanting their gunnery sergeants to give them some view while they're in the Marine Corps of whether or not their people are suitable to remain in the Marine Corps. My point is, how was that admitted into evidence in a trial, particularly penalty phase in a capital case in the state of Delaware, what the Marine gunnery sergeant thought sometime in the past about whether or not a person who's facing the death penalty at the time he knew them had a conscience or didn't have a conscience?
Well, I think it came down ultimately to the question of whether Norcross was a credible person or not, and he had he did testify at the penalty hearing, so I think ultimately that was an issue before the jury to resolve, was whether Norcross was credible in these self-reports or not, and that's admissible opinion evidence.
Well,
for
a person without
purpose.
A conscience can tell the truth. The context in which that question is asked and the answer is given is troublesome to me. Persons facing the death penalty forget for a minute, although we never can, about what brought them to that stage. But how do we get down the path where we can call indiscriminately people from their past and ask them for their personal opinion on whether at the time they knew them, not while they're facing the death penalty, but at the time they knew them, they formed a personal opinion about whether or not that person had a conscience? How is that other than inflammatory? How is it helpful in the first instance? How does it assist the jury? And secondly, how can it be anything other than designed purposely, if not deviously, to be inflammatory?
Well, I don't think it was deviously designed. The only reason he was presented was that the record evidence couldn't be presented, so they had to bring in the individual if he was going to testify.
The record evidence of whether he had a conscience or not?
No, the Marine Corps record evidence. The state initially wanted to offer the Marine Corps record evidence, and I think a Major Cox was introduced for that purpose as a custodian, and then there was an objection.
Well, okay, a record that say he was AWL eight times, that's evidence of irresponsibility, that he didn't eat three meals a day, that he didn't keep his gun clean, he didn't polish his boots. This is a question which elicited an answer, as I understand the record, that this particular sergeant in the Marine Corps believed that Booker was a man without a conscience.
Yes, and I think that's as appropriate opinion evidence as expert medical or psychological opinion evidence about someone's motivations in life. If those type of medical opinions are going to be admissible, then there isn't any reason not to allow Sergeant Booker to testify to his opinion. He certainly has recognized expertise in that limited area, and that's one of the things the Marine Corps tries to develop. If there's any additional questions, I'll attempt to answer those. All right. Thank you, Your Honors.
One minute and 14 seconds, according to the trusty time clock.
The clock must be wrong, Your Honor. I'm sure I have 6 minutes.
I'm sure you don't.
I'm sure I don't, too. But let me make the most of it. let me begin by pointing out that both Justice Rehnquist in reversing Booth and Gathers and Justice O'Connor in her concurrence indicated that the holding was limited to overruling Booth and Gathers based upon the evidence adduced in the Payne trial. However, it also said we do not reach an opinion, and they seem to be disinclined to do this, about opinions about the crime or the defendant. And merely because they reference family members not being able to do that, I think going to the point about the gunnery sergeant being able to offer that Norcross didn't have a conscience is a clear violation of Payne. The state also keeps talking about this nexus between mitigation and the crime. They did it at trial. They did it today again. And quite frankly, that's just wrong. Tenard versus Dirac, the United States Supreme Court said there need not be a nexus between mitigation evidence and the crime. It's about the individualized background of the defendant. It's about how you get there. And all the things you've heard from Ms. Aronson and I have talked about how Norcross got to be the person he was, the ADHD. This wouldn't have been a battle of experts. The neuropsych testing is done by the psychologist. If the psychologist comes up with that, that's the evidence you put on. Mechanic doesn't do that. He doesn't do that testing. He does other evaluations. And Dr. Mack found all his testing to be within valid limits, and that's cited in our brief.
You refer to ADHD. Does the record show that your client picked up the shell casings after the killing?
Your Honor, I apologize. I can't recall that.
All right, thank you, Mr. Gavet.
I thought I was out of time. I thought I had more time. I apologize. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Your Honor.